This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. As we near next week's primary election, as well as the November general election, there's been an even greater focus on U.S. politics. But these conversations can become stilted by our own knowledge gaps about how government works in our country. We want to give people a better working knowledge of how our political system developed here in the U.S., how it's changed over time, and how it functions today. Phil Rocco is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, and he joins me now to talk about U.S. government and politics. Phil, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, always good to be here, Joy.
I think like a lot of people, I'm somewhat versed in our political system, but there's a lot of things that end up being a little confusing. So how do we define the political system we have here in the United States?
When I think about the political system in the United States, I think about the fact that we have two major features that really make up our politics and define the way that our politics works. The first is federalism, or the fact that we have different levels of government whose powers are sort of in balance, sometimes in competition and sometimes collaborating with one another. And then we also have the separation of powers, or the fact that we have three separate branches of government at the federal level, a president, a legislative branch of the Congress, and an independent judiciary. And if you think about it, many of the main sort of conflicts, contentions arise out of those separations of power between levels and the separation of power between branches. It sets up a lot of the conflicts that we see. There's a misconception that there's some sort of difference between being a republic and a democracy. When in a conversation and somebody says that, I always have to point them back to the writings of the founders, in that the founders really didn't make much of a distinction between what we think of as a representative democracy. So we elect people to represent us. If we don't like them, we throw them out. They don't really make much of a distinction between that and a republic. That's sort of what a republic is. When they distinguish that from a democracy, small d, what they mean is that we're not, as all of the people in the polity, voting on every decision that comes before us. What they mean is that there are people who represent us. But the way that they do is fundamentally structured by these separations of power.
You just brought up, of course, the writings of the founders. And this is something that continually comes up today, the kinds of things that really regulate how our government is meant to function. When we talk about these things that define how our government works, what are we talking about? Is that the Constitution? Is that, you know, different laws and regulations? What are the kinds of things that really govern this system outside of the people elected to work in it?
I really think about there being five major sources of law in the United States. There's the old common law, which derives from the sort of British tradition, and that's displaced whenever we make law in another way. And those other ways include the Constitution, which really sets the parameters for most of what we think of happening in the American government. There's statutes. That's what Congress makes. That's what legislatures make. There's administrative rules or executive orders, and those are made by the executive branches of the federal and state governments, but those are made typically pursuant to, or they have to justify themselves with reference to legislation, right? They can't just necessarily do anything that they want. They're sort of circumscribed by legislation. And then there's what voters pass at the ballot box in states that allow that to happen. And that is law that derives from a vote and action of the people.
Yeah. So can you give us an example of how these different things interact, in the real world?
I think probably the most important example of this, and it's happening this year because it's 2020, is the census. And the census isn't just a statistical survey. It's the thing that defines how many members of Congress your state gets. It defines the way that states shape how many representatives an area of the state gets in redistricting. So it's really, really important. but it works through an interaction of these different elements of law. So in Article 1 of the Constitution, it requires there to be an actual enumeration of all persons residing in the United States every 10 years. It doesn't make a distinction between whether or not those people are citizens or not. It's all whole persons. Now, Congress has to make law to enact and supervise the implementation of that part of the Constitution. And so there's something called the Census Act. And in the Census Act, Congress is taking on its responsibility under Article 1 to every 10 years provide for a census. Now, back in the 19th century, Congress used to have to design the census every 10 years by committee. And there was no Census Bureau. They had to sort of hire people on the fly. It was a very messy, messy process. As we move to the 20th century, we have a Census Bureau. And so what Congress is doing in the Census Act is it's telling the Census Bureau how it is supposed to do its job, where it is supposed to enumerate people, when it's supposed to enumerate people, how the numbers have to be delivered, so that we can ultimately, every 10 years, make sure that the composition of Congress looks like the population, that places that have more population are getting more representation in the House of Representatives. Now, that is what Congress passes, right, the Census Act. Then the executive branch has to make rules that interpret what Congress means when it passes the Census Act. And that includes rules about where they're going to indicate people's place of residence. So, for example, college students who are living on campus most of the year and are home with their parents in the summer, even though their parents might claim them as a dependent, for example, for tax purposes, they're still going to be enumerated at their college. That's something that emerges from the residence rules from the Census Bureau. And when there is, you know, conflict about what the executive branch is doing on the census, challenged to its interpretation of the Census Act or the Constitution, then things move typically to litigation in the courts. And so you can see just one piece of the Constitution, the census, but many different sources of law that go into how it works every 10 years.
So the idea is ultimately that no branch of government should really be working by itself, that they all are different cogs in the same machine.
Yes. And I think that sometimes in civics class in school, people are familiar with like a triangle that shows different branches of government that have different checks and balances on one another. And the idea is that, you know, Congress does the legislating and the executive branch does the enforcement and the judicial branch does the sort of mediation, right, defining what the law is. But that's actually, you know, I think misrepresents to some extent the fact that these are separated branches of government that share power with one another, and that in fact that checks and balances system is not a sort of self-propelling machine. The idea in the writings of the founders was sort of borrowed from the sort of physical sciences of the day, that there would be some sort of counterbalance because each institution would defend its own prerogatives, sort of jealously guard those own prerogatives, ambition made to counteract ambition, I think is the phrase from Madison. But, you know, in reality, the founders didn't necessarily envision there being nationalized political parties of the sort that we have presently. In some instances, there are really strong incentives for the legislative branch to give the executive branch, vest it with a lot of power, and create an ability for the executive branch to make that checking and balancing of the legislative particularly difficult.
You know, you mentioned the party system here in the United States. How did they imagine parties would work in the United States? And why has it developed differently?
Well, I think the founders were not naive to the fact that when people engage in any kind of political action, that they're going to form groups. There's sometimes this misunderstanding that the founders, you know, they didn't imagine that parties could possibly, you know, exist. But that's not quite true. In the sense that they did know that people would form sort of around collective interests in some way. This was already present at the moment that the Constitution was struck because you had, for example, a merchant class, you had plantation owners, you had slave owners, you had non-slave owners, you had different sort of economic sections of the country that the Constitution is really the product of them warring with one another over their own interests, right? It's a sort of composite picture of those interests. So they were really aware of that. I think what they didn't possibly imagine was that you would have mass political parties with sort of symbols and labels and a lot of participation in those sort of stretching across different levels of government. And I think that that is something that really quickly developed, obviously, after the founding. But it's not something that I think the founders were necessarily thinking of when they were thinking of the way that government would be composed.
Well, now when we look at the three branches of government at the federal level, I think what you're saying is we've seen this play out with the Senate, with the House in some situations, giving power to the executive branch in a way that doesn't really fit with how we viewed these different branches working initially.
I mean, if you think about the two sort of twin problems that I think really contributed to defining the founding is, one is, you know, obviously a real concern about tyranny in the form of the tyranny of a crown. There was no model for what an executive looked like, a president, other than something that looked like a king. So there's a lot of concerns about that. But then there's also the concern about the Articles of Confederation, which preceded the founding, which were really a system of government that gave very little ability to the government to coordinate its action, to coordinate the production of currency, to coordinate the production of national defense or raising an army to defend its territory. Those are really sort of the two sort of twin conflicts that are propelling the design of the Constitution. But the emergence of a national economy, the emergence of sort of industrial capitalism brings with it some greater demand, wherever that demand might emerge from, whether from the capitalist class or from workers for defenses against the Industrial Revolution. But it creates a demand for an executive branch to administer a greater scope of both the economy, but also international relations. So you get this sort of rise of executive branches really internationally. And that creates challenges for actually maintaining some of the logic, the Madisonian logic of the system. So I'll give you one example, which is that following the Second World War, we saw the real increase in the number of federal agencies between the war and the New Deal. And there are real questions about how are we going to make sure that these agencies are acting within the scope of the laws that Congress passed. And so one of the things that Congress does in the mid-1940s is it passes something called the Administrative Procedure Act, which gives some guidelines and some pretty prescriptive rules that the executive branch has to follow when it makes its own administrative rules. It has to allow for a comment period. It has to publish the rules before it puts them into place. It has to make rules that have some clear bearing from the law. And its rulemaking decisions are subject to, in most cases, judicial review. So what Congress has to do at that point is sort of use the power of statutes to reinscribe its checks and balances sort of role in the constitutional system after the executive branch increases. But this doesn't always happen. One example I like to think about here is that, you know, as the executive branch is sort of gaining sort of leverage over the course of the latter half of the 20th century, Congress does not always expand its own capacities in response to that. And, you know, in the 1990s, Congress actually divests itself of a lot of key institutions that help it challenge and sort of exert its authority over the executive branch. It eliminates what was called the Office of Technology Assessment, which provided assessments of technological decisions made by the executive branch. It drastically reduces funding for the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, and it eliminates something called the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, which was the sort of only place where actors from multiple levels of government could sort of formally meet with one another and talk about the effects of federal decisions on state and local governments. So Congress really divests itself a lot of those capacities. And I think the impact of that is, on the one hand, the executive branch gains a lot of power over the legislature. But at the same time, I think you see this is a kind of windfall for lobbying organizations who step in to provide some of the expertise that Congress has divested itself of.
So what we're seeing now is we have a president who has said, you know, the Constitution gives him the right to do anything he wants. We've had a Congress that, as you mentioned, has divested itself from expanding its own powers. It feels like the systems aren't balancing one another the way that they necessarily were meant to. Where do we go from here?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point, is you have this confusion about, you know, what is the appropriate role of the executive branch? And if Congress isn't able to check the branch, sort of what do we do about that? And I think that there are sort of two sets of reform proposals that are out there. On the one hand, there are political scientists like Will Howell and Terry Moe at University of Chicago and Stanford, respectively, whose position is the executive branch is sort of growing, and rather than try to resist that growth, what we need to do is provide a framework to make sure that it's playing a legitimate role. So they sort of argue for formalizing some of those expanded powers, right? Giving the president the ability to make sort of take it or leave it type decisions that Congress has to, you know, vote up or down within a certain number of days. There's another approach, and I would say a, you know, maybe more Madisonian approach, which is to say, before we, you know, just sort of assume that the growth of the executive branch is ineluctable, that we need to really give Congress powers that it has not been able to exercise. And, you know, we need to make sure that there are adequate staffs, that committees are able to meet, that we have regular order, that people are sort of spending a certain number of days in session and doing oversight of the executive branch, and that Congress has the analytical capacities that it needs to check the executive branch.
Yeah. Well, Phil, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yeah, my pleasure, Joy.
Phil Rocco is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. You can hear our previous conversations at wuwm.com.